Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show, and our panel are here on the darkest day of the year to shine some light into the inner chamber themselves. But we'll have a look at the front pages of the papers first. So the Sunday Times is leading with John Mooney has a fascinating piece with a member of the Irish Military Intelligence Service. Apparently this is the first time anyone from the Irish Military Intelligence Service has ever been authorised to give an interview. The front page story they've taken out of it is that the IMIS has provided confidential briefings to university leaders, warning them about the risks associated with Chinese engagement in sensitive areas of research, particularly in fields that could be adapted for military use. But there's loads more in that interview, which seems to be, on one hand, to warn us about the dangers now of hybrid war and all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, to tell us that actually we are more on top of this than we might be led to believe. And indeed, there kind of almost seems to be a suggestion in that piece that part of this narrative that we are the weak link in everything is actually being fomented by the Russians. So, like, we don't even know what it is that the Russians are telling us to believe and what it is that is true anymore. I'm exaggerating slightly, but anyway, the Sunday Independent, we must speed up sacking process, says HSE chief. So that's Bernard Gloucester, the chief executive of the HSE, said new laws are needed to speed up staff dismissals and hold public servants to account. He says, I absolutely believe that the accountability procedures we operate in, they're not sustainable into the future if you want appropriate accountability. They're civil-based. They're too open to the very highly litigious environment of employment law in Ireland. They go on for years. The Business Post is leading with the fact that PTSB can grow to be a significant contender to AIB and Bank of Ireland if it is bought by Austrian bank BAWAG. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. And an expert industry analysis obtained by the Business Post reveals. So what they're essentially saying is we have a 2.5 bank model in Ireland at the moment, but that with the right buyer for PTSB, there could be a 3 bank model. The Irish Mail on Sunday, New Year by-election showdown for Martin. So this is two independent Ireland TDs threatening to try and force early votes for the two empty Dáil seats. That's Dublin Central and Galway West. And the Mirror, there must be proper justice for Sean. That's Micheál Martin telling Lebanon's Prime Minister that there needs to be real accountability for the death of Irish peacekeeper Private Sean Rooney. Now, our panel this morning, Mary Hanafin is a barrister and a former Fianna Fáil Minister for Education. Louise Byrne is political correspondent at the Irish Examiner. Oisín Coughlan is a public policy advisor, and Professor Gary Murphy is Professor of Politics at DCU. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brendan.
So, Oisín, will we start with that, the front page of the Mail on Sunday, which is kind of, there's a lot in the paper still about Fianna Fáil and Micheál Martin and everything, but this is a fresh spin on it by John Drennan and John Lee.
Yes, they think that, they're reporting that two independent Ireland TDs are going to try to accelerate the timetable for the election, for the two by-elections caused by Catherine Connolly's election and Pascal Donoghue's assumption to the World Bank, to move the writ if the government doesn't do so in the Dáil when the Dáil comes back in January. Now, the government could vote that down. The government has the majority, but that isn't normally done. But normally, the people who...
Well, as J.D. Vance would say, are you afraid of your own election if they were to vote
yes,
that down?
Yes, but yeah. I wonder, I mean, there's another article and paper about, you know, the fact that people are less interested in the machinations inside the Dáil and the parties than they are in delivery. I wonder how much notice the public would pay if this by-election doesn't happen until June, which from all we can see, and Louise might know more, is the government's preferred timetable. Wait the 6 months, have it just before the EU presidency of Ireland starts, so that no matter what the result, it gets lost in the summer break. So I would say the government will resist this particular effort to embarrass them, and I'm not convinced it will cause another setback for Micheál Martin.
Yeah, Gary, so people mightn't be 100% clued in on this. They might think it's up to the government to move the writ. So it's more, is it that the tradition is that whoever lost whoever lost their deputies, whoever caused the by-election, moves the writ. But anyone can technically move a writ, yeah.
Yeah, well, we have a former chief whip here sitting next to me, Brendan, who might be able to give...
So you're moving the writ over to her, I see. Mary, do you remember the technicalities of this?
I don't. I think it is a tradition that it is.
I think it's a tradition
rather than a rule. Yeah. If I'm correct, that it was the party who held the seat who move it.
Anyone can move a writ in the Dáil for a by-election, but it is tradition that those who have lost would do it normally. But as Gáisín said, the government can certainly vote it on.
But it has to be done within the 6 months.
Well, 15 years ago, there was a big court case taken by Sinn Féin when the government dragged its heels, the government of Brian Cowan dragged its heels about the by-election up in Donegal, which Pierce Doherty won in 2010, beating Breen O'Donnell. The night before, it was the week the Troika came to town, and Brian Cowan made a barnstorming speech on the Saturday night before the Troika came on Sunday, and people remember the freezing snow of that night, and the Taoiseach and Brian Lenihan and the army of civil servants looking, to be frank, a bit miserable as the Troika were coming. But since then, and there was a court case taken, which is a 6 month rule. So I think actually the election would have to be in May, not June. The Mail story is that Michael Collins of Independent Ireland and his ilk are keen to have it very early in the new year. But I agree with Oisin. I think the government will wait till May. Weather will be a bit better. Governments have terrible records in by-elections, as we know. I think the current Minister of Foreign Affairs is the last government person, Helen McEntee, to win a by-election in 2014. If you look at 2019, Fine Gael lost all four by-elections. And 2 months later, that presaged the disaster of the 2020 general election. But they're interesting because A, Catherine Connolly, a successor, will you see a United Left candidate? And B, in Dublin Central, I mean, Sinn Féin almost have to win that by-election in the heartland of its party.
So there's no expectation that the government would do well in these by-elections. Is it how badly they do, Louise, is the issue, yeah?
I think so, and I think, and it's within this Mail on Sunday report about, you know, Micheál Martin's leadership of Fianna Fáil, people saying, you know, if he does poorly in those elections, well, then that's going to turn the attention back on whether or not he can maintain his leadership of the party. But I think it is fair to say the government does not want to do these first thing in the new year. Winter elections are never popular. You know, people are a bit miserable after Christmas. They're broke. It's dark. It's cold. If there's snow, it's probably going to be within the first few months of a new year. So there is an expectation that both of these by-elections will be held on the same day, which I think is helpful, but also later in the new year. And don't forget, people are like, from a purely selfish point of view as well, people are so tired of covering these elections that I think everyone just wants a break. Like, emotionally, I actually don't think I'd be able to do an election so early into the new year.
Yeah.
So, but the TDs and the parties are the same. Like, if you think about it, we've had the local and European elections in June of last year. We had the general election. We had the presidential election. Hopefully, this will be the last election for quite a long time. But I think people are just electioned out of it now. So I can see the government trying to let people recover from the last couple of elections and pushing this out closer to the summertime when the evenings are a little bit longer.
Now that you've said that, Louise, I think the Taoiseach will call the election just to spite you early in the new year. But I think there's an interesting subplot in the Dublin Central where the Micheál Martin's preferred candidate, Mary Fitzpatrick, is being challenged by a Bertie Ahern candidate who did well in the local elections last year. So that could keep alive this old Fianna Fáil versus Micheál Martin Fianna Fáil split.
Mary, why is Bertie Ahern still involved potentially in a by-election in Dublin Central?
I can't see Bertie being involved at all. And actually, by his own admission, I'd say he would say he doesn't have the numbers at a convention to be able to secure any particular candidate
in his own heartland
through.
Okay.
And that has slipped over the years. Now, whether Fianna Fáil will run Mary Fitzpatrick again, I don't know. She's the obvious one insofar as she's the senator. There is a good councillor there. But Fianna Fáil is not going to win that by-election. Fianna Fáil is not going to win the Galway one, neither is Fine Gael. Governments do not win by-elections.
Okay.
Mary Fitzpatrick has ran for a long time.
This will be her sixth. This will be her sixth time running if she contests
with
this election.
No success. So, and although a very effective councillor, and Fianna Fáil use her a lot to go out and defend the
party. Good old scrapper on the media.
Yeah, but I do think it is probably a bit of a stretch. Fianna Gael will be interesting because they have a very good candidate in Ray McAdam, but we assume he'll be the candidate, the current Lord Mayor of Dublin, and certainly not afraid to take on the left. And but I mean, if Sinn Féin don't win the Dublin Central by-election in the heartland of the party leader, what does that say for the great alternative that Mary Lou MacDonald and Sinn Féin want to lead?
OK, so let's get down to the substantial issue of what all this is about. And as I was saying, Mary, there's still the major political story in the paper today, the Fianna Fáil leadership and Micheál Martin. What piece jumped out to you?
There's pages. I mean, Shane Ross is in the Sunday Independent, Conal Thomas in the Sunday Indo, you have Megan O'Brien in the Business Post, you have Shane Coleman, you have a fellow called Gary Murphy rising here.
Yeah, what did you learn that you don't know?
I think at this stage I probably know most of what all this is about. But what's jumping out on a few of the articles is the fact that when the chips were down this week, and when the Taoiseach went into the Dáil on Wednesday, there was no minister beside him. No minister spoke.
This is in Shane Ross's piece.
In Shane, it's in one of the other pieces as well.
Now, Jim O'Callaghan was up the end of the row somewhere. As Shane Ross said, he's able to nod at Micheál Martin while winking at the rebels as well.
So, and to also couple that with the fact that they didn't speak up at the actual meeting itself. I don't think
Timmy
Dooley,
I believe, is the only person who spoke up, a junior minister.
That's right, and he asked that the two of them, Billy Kelleher and the Taoiseach, would go and have a cuppa together. And
I don't think it was
either.
A cuppa, I think it might have been a pint.
I don't think that amounts to a whole heap of beans, actually, at this stage. And I've no doubt that the public feel that the report and the whole issue of the Fianna Fáil party is just one big yawn at this stage in relation to the
election. I'm hoping to get another 10 minutes here.
Let's
not bring in the yawn aspect yet.
Let's make it exciting.
You were mentioned in a lot of these dispatches, obviously.
That's right, and in the report.
Go on. What your read on the report and how it portrayed your situation?
Right, my read on the report is I think it's a very useful chronology. I think it tells us exactly in relation to when Jim Gavin became the candidate, when he was being talked to, what interviews were taking place. And yet we were all kind of kept in the dark in relation to that.
So reflecting now back on your own interactions and what you now know about the chronology around Jim Gavin.
Yes.
The bit that
stands out for me is that on the National Day of Commemoration in Kilmainham, when I kind of bumped into the Taoiseach and he said to me, I thought I was out the gap. In other words, he thought he was out the door without having to speak to me and gave me a complete cold shoulder and a 2 weeks before he had been speaking to Jim Gavin. Now, why couldn't he have said that, right? Or why couldn't he have indicated no at that stage?
And what did you say to him that day?
I asked him kind of what was happening. You know, I said, I don't hear of any other candidates coming around.
And did you had you indicated yourself at that point?
16th of May, I had.
Okay.
Right, so I'm out of the traps a good while.
You'd written to him?
At this stage. I had met him. Had been on your programme. It's quite public now at this stage.
So you had issued a come and get me plea very publicly at that point.
Yeah, I'm here.
So then he was hoping not to meet you that day. Did you harangue him further that day about...
The following week, I wrote to every member of the Parliamentary Party. The day Mairead McGuinness pulled out, I texted him again. Then I wrote again to the Parliamentary Party towards the end of August. Now, at any time between May and August, he could have picked up the phone and said, actually, you know, we have another candidate. And when he did ring me, and I answered the phone, I said, and where have you been all my life? Because he had ghosted me for the whole summer.
Maybe
I felt like a teenager, you know.
But maybe he was... Do you think there's any chance that he was trying to kind of spare your feelings and that maybe he just didn't want to say to you, look, Mary, you know, you're not a realistic goer for us here?
I mean, as I've said here before, he gave me the courtesy of a very long meeting in May, which I did appreciate it was after that. And he said to me, I know you would have wanted to say who it was. And I said, I understand the concept of cabinet confidentiality. No, I wouldn't. All I just wanted to know was for myself, you know, whether this was going to be a runner or not. And I think from the point of view of the report, whereas it does give a chronology and it does tell us that, I think it lacks analysis as well. Complete lack of analysis or even a comment. I think Bertie Ahern deserved a comment to say he was badly treated. I think it should have commented on the fact that Cynthia was just discarded.
I
think even to acknowledge that I was strung along.
Yeah.
You know, I think the report could have been strengthened by having an analysis.
But it was missing
as well
a pretty crucial piece of information as well, which is that which only came out on David McCullough the next day, that the Taoiseach was told about the questions about Jim Gavin.
I think there are two very big things. One is how did Jim Gavin get to be a candidate in the first place? And that's Fianna Fáil's problem. And that's Micheál Martin's problem. The second problem was the rent and the 3,800. That was Jim Gavin's problem. But the bigger issue is how did Jim Gavin get to be selected without any polling, without any previous...
Do you think you could have won a presidential election?
Brendan, I'm not so arrogant as to think that, right?
But you clearly thought you could have.
But I think I would have put in a very good campaign. And I think whatever polling took place in June, additional polling should have taken place when Mairead McGuinness pulled out, because the whole scene changed when Mairead McGuinness stopped.
Did you take part in the review, Mary?
I met them. Yeah.
And do you think, because I know Cynthia was on the radio, Cynthia Newark, who was on the radio earlier in the week, and she said she didn't feel that her, you know, input into the review was properly reflected in it. Do you think that yours was?
I think everything I told them is actually in the review. But remember, I had been much more public on what I had said. I had been on your programme, Brendan.
Notwithstanding your commitment to confidentiality and that the teacher could
have... No, but I only spoke in relation to myself.
Yeah, yeah.
If you remember, enough. I was here I came on here when I was pulling out. Right. So my candidacy had been very public.
Okay, we'll come back to you. Oisín, you
something that Mary raised that I want to comment on, which is the polling, the lack of polling about Jim Gavin before he was offered the candidature, the backing of the leadership. I ran for the Shannon in 2016 as an independent candidate, and I thought about running again in 2022. And I paid £800 to Kevin Cunningham and Ireland Thinks for a poll as to my chances on a campaign that would have cost €4,000 to €5,000. Fianna Fáil spent €400,000 without spending £800.
And you got a question in on one of their polls for £800 that told you what you needed to know.
Commercially sensitive information. So that is just extraordinary that the party as old as Fianna Fáil, as powerful as Fianna Fáil, as good at elections as Fianna Fáil, didn't do any polling of the candidate that the leader was backing above all others for this. And I do think it just shows something else as well, is that in this studio, I think it is when Micheál Martin spoke with David McCullough, he basically said, there's no one in the current parliamentary party I thought was worth a go. And then we know now he doesn't think there's anyone from the parliamentary party from the crisis crash era, Mary included, that was worth a go. It's kind of a funny position for the leadership to have, that nobody in my parliamentary party for the last 25 years is worth a go.
Was that part of it, though, that this has been mentioned, that there was a fear for if someone like Mary or Bertie kind of came into that conversation, that whole bad old Fianna Fáil period got evoked again.
The ghost of Fianna Fáil past, as I describe it in my own column this morning, with all due respect to Mary, who knows I have great respect for her.
to say that, he's sitting to my left.
But I thought Shane Coleman's piece in the Business Post was very interesting in the fact that he writes that in his gut, and then Micheál Martin's gut, he probably didn't want to fight the presidential election. Fianna Fáil had stood out in 2011 in the aftermath of said crash, and stood out in 2018 when the whole establishment rode in behind President Michael D. Higgins, and probably felt that that would be the best approach for Fianna Fáil. But with Fine Gael running a candidate, I think there was an expectation in Fianna Fáil that then they would have to run a candidate. And so he looked around in a bit of a De Valera a viewer. He looked into his own heart, didn't like what he saw, and went looking elsewhere. Now, the problem with Jim Gavin, I met Jim Gavin here on the Sunday in RTÉ that he did his week in politics, the debate.
You meet him before or afterwards?
I met him afterwards, just as I was going in to do the week in one analysis of the debate. And we had a quick word, as one does. He said, how do you think I got on? I said, well, a good bit better than the Virgin Media debate, which really wouldn't be very hard. He was like atrocious, let's put it frankly. And one of the interesting things about this this review, of course, that Jim Gavin didn't take part himself. But he didn't look like to me that he was a person just about to pull out.
But did you, was that before or after he did the media doorstep down in the reception?
It was before.
What happened at the doorstep?
So Jim Gavin came down and he was pressed by myself and a few of my colleagues basically about how he couldn't remember this issue of the €300, and he didn't really have any answers, and he was being, I mean, he was being pressed quite hard, and, you know, when we were coming away from it, we just thought he looked quite sad and like you wouldn't have thought that he was necessarily going to pull out later that evening, but I think we all kind of came away from it thinking that the writing was on the walls, and he couldn't answer the questions. And I mean this in no disrespect to his team, because I know the people who were on his team and they're very good, capable people, but he was kind of left to, I was haranguing him a little bit, trying to get answers from him, and like no one stepped in to be like, Louise, would you stop? Kind of thing. So I did, I felt a bit sorry for him that day. In hindsight, I didn't feel sorry at the time, but in hindsight, I did feel a bit sorry. Not that I'd done it, but I felt a bit sorry for him.
And of course, we know that he was essentially
sent
into a darkened room. Well, a bottle of whiskey in the morning.
But that afternoon, he was then told by Micheál Martin and Jack Chambers that Fianna Fáil couldn't basically support him anymore.
Now, we can't expect people to go out and campaign for you.
They could have told him before. Mm. They could have stopped him going on the week in politics. They could have simply said, because all the information was in Fianna Fáil's domain then. Nothing happened between him going on the week in politics
The Taoiseach had said previously about that this was a big decision for him. Family are involved in everything, that it couldn't be done quickly. Listen, let's move on to the current moment. So, Louise, whither Micheál Martin's leadership of Fianna Fáil now? Is it, as everyone kind of said at the beginning of all this, it won't be fatal, but it has shortened its time? Is that essentially where we're at?
I think my view on this is the whole time has been like Micheál Martin can't continue forever. So something was always going to be the beginning of the end. And as I said to one of his colleagues the other day, I've been in Leinster House 4.5 years, and I don't know how many times I've written stories about people coming after Micheál Martin's leadership. But I think perhaps this time it does feel a little bit more real. But that being said, he's defied expectations before. I think there now is an expectation that he will stay where he is until at least after the end of the EU presidency, which would be this time next year. I think very few people in Fianna Fáil believe that he's going to lead them into the next election. Very few people in Fianna Fáil believe that he is going to be Taoiseach. And I think what's been interesting the last few weeks is you can see senior ministers starting to come out and floating the idea of, you know, oh, well, like, I haven't thought about the leadership, but perhaps I could think about Jim O'Callaghan not denying it anymore.
Predict the future. Mary, what do you think of Dara Cleary today, who is kind of, I don't know, less than equivocal, is that the word I'm looking for? Like, because there's an assumption at the moment that, as if it's a done deal, Jim O'Callaghan just needs another year in cabinet, and then he'll be ready and he'll be the man.
There is that assumption. I have a lot of time for Dara Cleary. I know him a long time. I think Jim O'Callaghan is the man, though. I think he's performing very, very well as Minister for Justice and dealing with very sensitive issues well. He's only there a few months, 10 months or so. I think he would welcome having another year. But things change so quickly.
It could happen in another year.
Absolutely, I know.
And Dara Cleary, he's saying today, I am ambitious. I'm ambitious for the country, but
I thought that was a really telling line.
Yeah, it's a bit like I can't tell the future, isn't it?
But he does say that. But I mean, a year ago, Jack Chambers was the heir apparent, and now Jack Chambers certainly isn't because of judgment and a question of judgment. I agree with Louise. I think that the Taoiseach will certainly stay on and should be allowed to stay on until the end of the European presidency. Because I think it's important. I think there's an awful lot happening in the world stage. He's well positioned with his experience. He's a good Taoiseach.
So not for his sake and his dignity, which does seem to be part of
No, I don't think so. I think he's a good Taoiseach.
He should have this moment as the head of Europe.
Well, come to it. I think Europe is showing itself up to be weak. He is a strong leader. If you have Putin calling the leaders of Europe little pigs, then you need somebody with experience who's able to stand up, and I think Micheál Martin will fill that role. His question of judgment is in relation to the Fianna Fáil party. I think that does say a lot about a leader, but personally I think he could and will stay until the end of the European presidency announce he's off.
Okay, so let's get to the broader kind of look back of the year. Louise, when Mary mentions the Taoiseach's judgment there. People have been calling the Taoiseach's judgment into account since the start of the year, really. It began with the Lowry thing, didn't it? You were looking at... what about Matt Cooper's A to Z of the political year? What jumped out for you there?
Yeah, this was a great piece from Matt. And I think when you get to this time of the year, you actually oftentimes forget how mental it's been. Like, when you think that this time last year, we had just come out of the election, we were really just entering in to the government formation talks. But Matt has a great piece. And some of the interesting ones I found, so his A to Z, C for Catherine Connolly, obviously the biggest political moment of the year, becoming the next Uachtaráin na hÉireann. G's for Jim Gavin. K for Billy Kelleher. L, what would you put down for L now?
Louise.
Obviously, but after that, I would have actually put Michael Lowry. He put the left, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, and Michael Lowry's in there.
Lowry's in there all right somewhere.
Yeah.
T for tariffs. Do you remember the tariff discussion in April? Doesn't that feel like a million years ago? Perhaps quite tongue-in-cheek from Matt. Y for Ivan Yates, his involvement in the presidential election. So I thought it was just a nice look back. I mean, you things like H for housing, you're always going to have housing in there, I for infrastructure. But it's been a mad year. And I think it's only when you look back on it, like the speaking round, that feels like a million years ago. But yet it only really resolved itself in the summertime, because with the establishment of committees, you had the committees down for so long because of this whole speaking round. So it's been a real, I think, lethargic start to the year. But a lot has happened.
The government are denying the kind of do nothing doll thing and saying there is actually going to be plenty legislation by year's end. I think 20 pieces of legislation, and that's not that unusual. But when you say all those things together there, it sounds like a lot of the political energy of the year and the energy of you and your colleagues has been taken up with like unforced errors by the government and you know, procedural messing.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think it's reflective in the Dáil schedule. If you look at the Dáil schedule any given week, you have statements on, you know, a range of different things, and statements on important things, that's not to be said. But you haven't had those really, you're starting to see it now a little bit towards the end of this year and the last couple of weeks, kind of, you know, back and forth on actual legislation. And I mean, if you think back, to bring it back to the speaking row, you know, the government were saying, well, we can't get legislation through cabinet because we can't refer it to the committees, which does the pre-legislative scrutiny on the legislation that the government is bringing through, because the opposition are dragging their feet and they won't let the committees be set up because of this speaking row. Then the opposition are turning back and saying, no, we're happy to let the committee set up. And, you know, in hindsight, who was wrong? Probably both sides to a certain extent. But there has been very little legislation, and that has been reflected not only in the cabinet agendas but also in the Dáil committees and the Dáil schedule itself. So it's been a funny year, I will give them that. Like, when you think about it, you had the speaking row with the committees being set up, the committees were set up, I think it was June, you were on your summer recess in July, coming back in September, all attention on the budget, then you had the election, the presidential election, then you had the fallout from that. So it's been a weird year. So I think everyone is looking forward to getting back to actual proper work next year. We'll see if it happens, but I think there's a hope that that is what will happen.
Oisín?
I mean, I think it's a reflection as well of the fact that of the parties in government. Fine Gael have been there for 14 years now, and albeit that Fianna Fáil have only been there for 5 in government, they've been in confidence and supply since 2016. And then the government is being supported by a mixed bag of rural independents. And I think it is different then compared to when you have either the PDs or Labour or the Greens as the third leg of a coalition, who tend to bring an ideological urgency to what they want to get done. So the committees is a real thing, but in 2020, the government was formed in June, and the Greens had the Climate Action Bill out in 101 days, and by Christmas of a half year had been through pre-leg. So there was an urgency to get big stuff done. That doesn't appear now. They'll say they're setting up for emergency legislation next year.
Yeah,
but we'll see.
There is a kind of an ideological urgency now around what you might broadly call this abundance kind of philosophy of, like, you know, there's a lot of action going on around infrastructure and housing.
Yeah, that's
true.
There's
a lot happening around immigration.
There is. But it is still a fact that this government in its first year has introduced less bills, fewer bills, than any government in a generation since in the 21st century.
Is that, that's a fact?
That's a fact, yeah. Okay. Unquestionably. Now, will there... There's a lot on at the end of the year to come, but I I think at one stage I said in a column a few weeks ago that the government looked tired and lethargic, only a year in office, and I think I would stand by that. What strikes me about the speaking rights, though, issue is it showed for the first time a very different opposition than we've had for a long time, much more aggressive, much more assertive, and it did presage the alliance that forged behind Catherine Connolly in her attempt, her successful attempt to become president, when Sinn Féin rode in behind her in September, where people might have mocked Mary Lou MacDonald for describing it as a game changer, but it certainly was a game changer because Sinn Féin rode in on the ground and rode in with a massive vote for her. Assuming most people who vote Sinn Féin would have voted for Catherine Connolly in the presidential election. Okay. And I do think that that is that. Sorry, just to move forward. Yeah. Over the next year or so, I think this idea of an alternative government led by Mary Lou MacDonald, including Sinn Féin, the Greens, the Social Democrats, no, I think it'll be a cold day in hell before people of profit ever go into government, but potentially the hard left. And I think that'll be one of the defining features of this Dáil, that we might see a potential government in waiting.
But I think the thing is, the last couple of months, it's been easy. Like, the speaking row was easy. The presidential election, to a certain extent, was easy. What about when it comes to policy? Mm. You saw in the Dáil the other week, you know, Sinn Féin, for example, opposing the banning fox hunting, which is something that the Social Democrats have rode in behind. How do you marry that? And I mean, they are, yes, they are to the left in the Dáil, but they obviously have different raison d'etre and different policy points and views. And how do you keep working together over the 4 years? Is it, you know, it's very easy on the speaking rights row because it's something that impacts them all. But when it comes to policies, how can they marry it together? And I remember speaking to someone.
You have negotiations to get a programme for government.
You do. But
I think, Brendan, it's almost as if the government only started in the last few months.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it's just so late getting off the ground because of the speaking rights. Then you had the presidential election in the summer. Then you had Pascal Donoghue going. It's only almost now as if they're starting into the beginning of a 5 year term. So I think now that you've had plans on infrastructure, you've had promises and threats on judicial reviews and legislation on that, you have housing plans and investment on that, I think it's probably from the beginning of next year that we'll actually see things motoring. Ministers were no sooner in their jobs when some of them were reshuffled out of it. So it's now that you have the beginning of the next 4.5 years, I believe.
Okay, so next year is the first year of the rest of our lives, Mary.
Almost.
Before we leave this, Mary, just on reflecting on the year, you picked Alison O'Connor's reflections on the political year. Connolly tops class in my political report card.
Yeah, I mean, the two, I suppose, Matt Cooper, Day to Day, and Alison O'Connor are kind of similar in their ways. I'm sure everybody is thrilled to have a K and a Kelleher and an X and X and Yeats, because these are letters that you'd never normally be able to fill. But yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, I mean, Catherine Connolly is the big winner of the year. So, and her election was so significant that Alison talks about that. But she also mentions Kelleher. Verona Murphy.
Could you have beaten her?
No, I'm not going to say that. But I think the campaign would have been completely different if you'd had a strong middle candidate. I think questions that went unanswered would have been forced.
Do you think Heather Humphreys was not
would have been answered, I think.
Was Heather Humphreys not a strong enough candidate?
No, Heather obviously wasn't a strong enough candidate. That's why I'm saying polling should have taken place after Marie.
Are you saying President Connolly effectively had no real opposition?
I think she played a blinder in the campaign. She absolutely didn't answer questions, but there was no other candidate there to challenge her in doing that. So a campaign.
Would you have been better at it,
No, look, a campaign with a third candidate.
I'll happily say it. I think Mary would have been better. I don't think Mary would have been would have won the election. I think Fianna Fáil could have had a better candidate than Mary, certainly. But if Mary was the candidate, at least Fianna Fáil would have had a message and they would have had someone to sell that message. I mean, I thought Billy Kelleher would have been a good candidate. Mm. He could have said, I've been in Ukraine, I've been wearing my flak jacket, wandering around, seeing the ruins of Europe and the threat from Russia. I've been in Moldova. I know what it's like to be on the sort of the front line. And he could have taken Catherine Connolly's view of foreign affairs on. Mary could have taken it on. And I think this is the big fiasco for Fianna Fáil, that the candidate couldn't do those things and then didn't even last the course.
Okay, let's take a break. Mary Hanifin, Louise Byrne, Oisín Coughlan and Professor Gary Murphy staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Get professional advice on blood pressure and glucose checks at All Care Pharmacy.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Professor Gary Murphy, Oisín Coughlan, Mary Hanafin, who was just offered Louise Byrne a signed copy of the Fianna Fáil report. Now, Gary, I think people might find the John Mooney spy stuff in the Sunday Times. It's a difficult long read. It's dense, like, but there's a lot in it. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, there is. So John Mooney, who would have revealed Cobalt a couple of months back, and I think most people would accept as sort of the premier defence analyst in the country, has a byline piece at the front of the Sunday Times. Spy agency tells university to beware China. And this basically is a high-level intelligence group called, I must just get it right here now, the Irish Military Intelligence, what does the S stand for? Service, is guarding our country in a service we'd never even heard of. The intelligence in this country goes back a long way. There was a very impressive intelligence service during World War II, famous G2. So we have had an intelligence service for a long time. It's murky. No one's really sure how much money it gets. But John has a very interesting interview with an unknown person in this office, which is based in McKee Barracks. Apparently, there are signs all over: no photographs, no parking. When you come into this this building, and I think there's been a sense, which I might have shared, I have to say, that the defence services here were the weak link in our sort of in our geopolitical view of the world, and a touch of maybe the Keystone Cops about the defence. But according to this interview, nothing could be further from the truth. This guy does appear like a not quite a modern James Bond, but he's seen service on the in Afghanistan, in Mali, in some of the real hot spots. He's the negotiations with the Taliban, which I thought was fascinating. And he makes the point, which I think Mary would share and many others would, that Ireland has never been politically neutral. We've always been on the western side of sort of the geopolitical political debate between, if you go to the Cold War, between the West and the East. And I just found it very fascinating because I've worked in DCU for over 30 years. I know the pressure on the finances of the university system. I know what fees from foreign students, including Chinese students, do to our balance. They increase it. I know there are pressures that my colleagues on my side, well, not me, but my colleagues to engage with Chinese universities, Israeli universities, all sorts of universities to get grants, EU grants and the like. And I think that what the person John Mooney has interviewed is warning that there are potential dangers in terms of military intelligence, AI, and how the Chinese, as John phrases it, could use such information.
So just on that, when I was Minister for Education, we actually went as part of a trade mission to China to attract Chinese students into Ireland, both those learning English and those coming to the universities, and to attract collaborations with the universities.
And was that the beginning of the Confucius Institute?
That was the beginning of it. The Confucius Institute was then set up and opened by the Vice Premier, opened in UCD 20 years ago now, in 2006. But I think from the time it was established, there was a consciousness, certainly amongst the local schools around UCD, as to why they were reaching out so much to younger students to bring them in rather than just a research collaboration with UCD. And even at that stage, people started asking questions. But what John Mooney is saying in his article is much more sinister, because he's talking about the consequences of research collaboration. And if you're working with somebody and showing them how to make a knot on the right rather than on the left, well, then that's something that could be used for military capability.
You see, you'd wonder, Oisín, do the Chinese need to learn anything from us about technology? I mean, there's a general feeling that they're going to outstrip the US potentially with AI, moving with really cheap models that seem to be able to leapfrog past a lot of the very expensive US models. There were leaders in cheaper and cheaper and better EVs at this stage. They are making all the solar panels in the world at this stage, apparently. Like, what do they need our help?
I guess it's a belt and braces approach from China, in that they have invested an awful lot in their overseas reach, both diplomatically and potentially probably on the secret side as well. So, you know, we are this strange linchpin between the US and Europe with all the cables and everything else. I wouldn't surprise me if they take an interest in Ireland, even if they don't expect us to be the tipping point.
And of course, we take an interest in them in the sense that we are trying to broaden our international trade as well. And with America going the way it is, China is fertile ground
for us.
And
the Taoiseach is going to China on the first week of January on a trade mission of sorts, but I guess they're all trade missions in and of themselves, these visits. So there is that connection. But I also thought the interesting thing about this was, and probably I would see it as the more concerning one, is soldiers in Lebanon being approached by various nations looking for information or trying to recruit them. And this group has been able to work against that because the soldier involved, you know, they came and they told them. But
they are watching soldiers who, what they're putting up on social media and stuff, and the danger of soldiers getting radicalised.
What they say is that hasn't happened yet, and that is obviously very, you know, it's a good thing, but I think it's, albeit it's quite frightening content, it's nice to know that this group exists and that they are monitoring these things, because I think an awful lot of people would just assume that these things aren't being looked at.
This is a useful article, but I've watched enough seasons of Slow Horses to know you don't take for granted at face value what the Secret Service tells you about how well they're doing. So it's good to know they exist, and the threats they identify are real. But I guess there should probably be some sort of parliamentary oversight of what our Secret Services are doing and what they're for.
I'm sure somebody's looking after it. Mary, moving on, Lucinda Creighton in the Sunday Business Post today: multi-tier EU with Ukraine and UK will bolster us in a volatile world. But I mean, the substance of her piece is that the EU needs to get its act together, and we saw it again this week, kind of chaotic scenes.
Yeah, I must say, I like Lucinda's article there. I mean, she's basically saying that Europe is losing influence. We're losing it militarily, politically, economically, and stop the rotten soon. It's not just because the UK left. We've lost kind of 70 million people with them, so we do need to have a working relationship with them. We need to expedite the process of bringing the Ukraine in. We need to work with our nearest neighbours in the Balkans and to bring them in.
It seems like the 27 who were there can't agree. We now have the Eastern European countries this week, seemingly Czechia and Slovakia joining Hungary in kind of seeming to possibly go back towards a Russian sphere of influence, and we want to bring in more Eastern European countries.
You had that on the one hand, but then on the other you had this small little country, and we can speak on behalf of them, of Belgium, being able to stop the Russian assets being used. Now, maybe that's a good thing, but it meant...
Well, we didn't agree with it. We were on the other side of that argument.
We were definitely on the other side of it, but it shows how one small country out of the 27 can hold up everything. The Russian assets are there because Russia is the aggressor. But now Europe is going to take out a 90 billion euro loan to be able to support the Ukraine. So, I mean, Europe is weak, and in the changing world that we're in, it's not doing anything to strengthen itself. It's not broadening its bases. It's not talking to the UK. It's not dealing with competition. It's not dealing with regulation. And I think Lucinda's right in her article. It absolutely needs to act more decisively.
Yeah, or she.
I think that's overly pessimistic. I mean, first of all, it is a union, a political union of independent sovereign states. So it's like not like the US. There isn't a single president. I think, given that reality and given how much turbulence there is in the world, that the European Union is doing an okay job at trying to manage those relationships. And it wasn't the EU's fault that the UK left. And there is a lot of UK collaboration now around the Ukrainian solidarity aspect. And on the deal, there's an article by Bill Browder in the Times about the assets as well. I think that was quite a complicated one. I saw some reporting from the Irish Times, Jack Parra, saying when the idea of an unlimited guarantee to Belgium and to Belgian financial institutions was being raised as a way to raise the money, it might have given Micheál Martin pause for thought, because bank guarantees are something that are problematic and would have needed to come back to all the parliaments to get passed. So once Belgium wouldn't easily agree to it, they went for something that has equally been challenging, which was common debt. That's something that that Germany has opposed. And that was the fallback, was to go for common European debt in order to finance the loan. It was always going to be a loan, but there was a question whether it would be financed.
We won't get into the weeds on this, but that had been taken off the table. down until about 2 in the morning, and suddenly then, oh, we're going back to that plan B that we disregarded as not being a good plan.
But they got the outcome they needed to get, which was because I think it would have been utterly disastrous.
I think it was viewed as a massive failure for von der Leyen and for Costa.
Costa was here the week before that again, and he was doing a press conference with Micheál Martin, and what he had said is that, you know, he very much seemed to indicate that this idea of using the frozen Russian assets was going to go ahead with, you know, the support, as much support as he could possibly get. But I think for Belgium, and in fairness to Belgium, this was, you know, how would they be trusted again to hold anyone's assets? So there was more at play for them. But it is seen as a failure, that because there was, bar Belgium, kind of wide enough spread support for these Russian assets.
But Hungary could have vetoed the fallback plan and didn't. And Zelensky won't mind that much where the money comes from as long as it's sent to him. And they did permanently freeze the Russian assets this week. Yeah. They don't have to go back every 6 months now. So I think it's an outcome that keeps us in the game.
Yeah. Okay. Gary, Brian Dobson is writing in the Sunday Independent today. President's presence at Herzog Park would have meant more than words.
Yeah, Brian Dobson, formerly of RT and the 6-1 fame, has a very, in my view, evocative
piece.
He's
actually better known now for the Brendan O'Connor Show Big Quiz of 2025. His current claim to fame.
But he's got a very evocative piece and a powerful piece where he basically charts the rise of anti-Semitism in the country and the issues that the Irish Jewish Representative Council have alerted him and others to of the rise in such incidents. It has the IJRC has recorded 113 anti-Semitic incidents in Ireland between early 24 and October of this year, directed at individuals, families and a Jewish organisation, and of that total, 77 have occurred in the last 6 months. And he makes the point basically that the president, President Connolly, who we've discussed already, while she did condemn the Sydney attacks and expressed her deepest sympathy to the Jewish community everywhere,
and
in
she
Ireland,
did so unequivocally,
completely unequivocally, and I think spoke for all of us as President should. But he does make the point that while she showed some solidarity with those who were running for Palestine in the Phoenix Park, went out to sort of wave them on during the week, that she basically could have attended a remembrance celebration in Herzog Park in Ratgar for those people who tragically lost their lives this day last week. And I was actually very moved by this piece because Brian points out that there are only a couple of thousand Jews in our country at the moment. The overwhelming sentiment of the country obviously is in favour of the Palestinian state, the two-state solution and a resolution to this awful war in Gaza. But there are certainly the potential renaming of Herzog Park a few weeks ago by Dublin City Council has brought this issue to the fore, and good for Dobson is what I would say.
Okay, now Louise, on remembrance and all of this, Valerie Hanley is writing in the Irish Mail on Sunday: Ring of Steel to guard Holocaust memorial. This is the annual very, very solemn Holocaust memorial service that is held in Dublin.
Yeah, and this takes place every year, but Maurice Cohen, again, of the Jewish Representative Council of Ireland, has confirmed to Valerie in the Mail on Sunday that Justin Kelly, the Garda Commissioner, and Jim O'Callaghan have assured them that there will be, you know, more support for them, and that will involve at the Holocaust Memorial Service, which I think it usually takes place in January. I think it's usually in the Mansion House. And, I mean, it kind of takes you back when you even think that has to happen, because I think while the vast majority of people, not everyone, but the vast majority of people in Ireland are supportive of Palestine, you would also hope that they're not going to take that out, Israel's ongoing actions, that they're not going to take that out against the Jewish community. And I think while those figures in Brian's report in the Sindo, and it was a very good piece by Brian Dobson, are very stark, you would hope that the majority of Irish people don't see it as, you know, the majority of people in Israel are Jewish, therefore it must be the Jewish people that are doing this to the Palestinian people. And I don't think most people see it like that, but if this is a concern that they have, it needs to be looked at. And what Maurice Cohen was saying is that after that awful atrocity and that anti-Semitic attack on Bondi Beach last week, that they have gotten more support. And I suppose you saw that last week, and quite an unprecedented statement put out by the Garda Press Office last Sunday afternoon saying that they would be increasing security, and that will be seen now at this Holocaust memorial.
Routinely armed guards on synagogues all over Europe, and have been for, I think, for a long time.
It's a shame that we have to do for something like that. As Minister for Education, I actually spoke at that event, and it is really so moving.
It's but an incredibly moving event.
One of the things that
event,
I will never forget is that the March of the Living in Auschwitz, which is hundreds of thousands of people coming, I actually addressed that as on behalf of the Minister of Education of Europe in Auschwitz, and I will never forget it. I'll never forget the silence, the respect, the horror, the memories that the world needs to remember. The world should never forget. And equating support for Palestine with anti-Semitism is, I think, one of the most dangerous things that has happened for Ireland and for Irish people, because it's the narrative now in America. It's eaten into the political attitude and the economic attitude towards Ireland. And I think we just need to be very careful at the way it's being portrayed.
Yeah, and equally, we all agree that people can be critical of Israel and Israel's appalling actions in Gaza without blaming Jews in Ireland. OK, we'll take a break. Mary Hanafin, Louise Byrne, Oisin Coughlan and Professor Gary Murphy staying with us. Welcome back, Mary Hanafin, Louise Byrne, Oisin Coughlan, Professor Gary Murphy still with us. So let's get into a Christmas miscellany now. Louise, you picked a piece by Jamie Boyes in the Irish Mail on Sunday about coming home for Christmas.
Yeah, this is a great piece, and I think any news reporter, used to be my favourite thing to do, was going out to Dublin Airport and seeing everyone come home. But Jamie managed to get a few people in Dublin Airport, including James Down from County Cork. And James brought three full-size suitcases home with them and said, "I'm only here for a month, so I thought I'd bring the washing home for me ma." which, I mean, you can send the Irish boys to New York and yet they'll never change. And then you have Rebecca Daly. What was she saying? She said something funny. Oh yeah, she said she missed her mum and her dog, but she's also missed smoky bacon crisps, Brennan's bread and my Waddy orange. So, and things I would probably miss as well when I'm home, but they're two of just 1.8 million people coming home or travelling through the airport this Christmas time. And it's lovely, and I've welcomed friends home in the last couple of days who it's been just wonderful to see for Christmas. So looking forward to seeing more of them over the next few days. But yeah, these really nice pieces at Christmas time. I think everyone always enjoys these.
Okay. Gary, Declan Lynch is writing in the Sunday Indo that the red card for Boxing Day football is an attack on our civilisation.
It's very funny. You can watch football 24/7 now. It's too much of it. But I remember growing up in the 1970s and 80s, you couldn't watch football at all. The FA Cup was the only game that was shown on RTE and on terrestrial TV, even on the BBC. But now people remember Stephen's Day, Boxing Day, was always a full football list on, and now there's only one game on, and Declan rightly bemoans the end of civilisation, and I would wholeheartedly agree. On Louise's point, I was in Dublin Airport yesterday to collect my daughter coming home from London. It took her forever to get from the plane to through arrivals. But there was a choir there. It was fantastic. There was people singing along, and a chap walked out. He was an elderly man, and his two grandchildren ran, and I thought they were going to bowl him over. Such was their excitement to him. I said, "He'll be in hospital if they don't stop."
That's probably the best moment of the Christmas reunion, when they all see each other initially, and then reality dawns on day two. Oisin, briefly, you picked the Irish Mail on Sunday, Colin McGurk writing about Rory McIlroy.
Yeah, Rory McIlroy won both the BBC Sports Personality of the Year and the RTE Sports Personality of the Year. The first time that's happened, apparently, since Barry McGuigan in 1985. And it has just been a particularly stellar year for him. And he navigates both his dual identity on this island and then the dual pressures between the different golf setups.
Yeah, did you see him playing that kind of relay grand slam under lights golf there during
the
week?
Exactly. Like, he's having fun. Yeah. And my sports moment of the year, though, was Kate O'Connor, the Irish female athlete. That was the best.
Okay. Mary, Lynn Keller has a piece in a couple of papers. She's in the Mail on Sunday today writing about, there's a documentary going out next week on RT, The Queen Mammy, Mary O'Rourke. Much like yourself, The women of a certain era of Fianna Fáil kind of managed to move on a bit better than a lot of the men and become kind of beloved and common sense and popular and everything.
I actually participated in that programme on Mary O'Rourke.
Yeah.
Cluck Le Cairn. They do fabulous programmes, I have to say, each year, and well done to
What's your outstanding memory of her?
When I was Minister for Education, to the job that she had held, so we had that common interest. I was also friendly with Brian for very many years. So when Brian was sick, I think we kind of used to liaise a bit on that, you know, which was a terrible ending.
Yeah, and she was very, very close to Brian.
She was very close, and she kept an eye out for him. But she was a very strong, very powerful figure within the parliamentary party. And as you say, afterwards, anyone going on radio commentator, writing books, etc. If what they're saying in the paper reflects what's in the programme, I recommend to people watch it. But finally, could I just say, today is the day of the solstice, Newgrange, and I was privileged in 2003 to actually be there on the morning, because the Taoiseach gave me his ticket because it was the year my husband had died, and I said, show me there is a God, you know.
Yeah.
But actually we were there and the light came in.
And did you see God,
It was, well, I tell you, there's people there for archaeology, for heritage, for history, for architecture. And there's people there to respect the dead because it is a burial tomb. But I came away that Christmas saying there is a God.
Okay. And we'll end on that note. Thank you very much to my excellent panel today, Mary Hanafin, Louise Byrne, Oisín Coughlan, Professor Gary Murphy. And thank you all for giving up your weekend before Christmas, because it's more than an hour, I'll tell people. It's a full weekend job. So thank you all very much, guys. It's now just after 12 noon, and we'll go to the newsroom.